Welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. As always, if you listen to the intros, follow me on Twitter at Conspiracy or JAC. I'm on Gab. I have a website, conspiracyorjustacoincidence.com. If you want to support the show, I have a Patreon, and on my website, it links to another support page. But if you leave a review, that I understand money is tight. I say the same thing always, so you must be getting bored. But if you totally get it, can't support the show, please leave a review. I'll give you a shout out on the show, or I can, you know, shout out your Twitter handle. Helps with the censorship that's already going on. Follow me, blah, blah, blah. Yes. So I got an awesome episode for you today. Andreas Xertas. Hopefully I said it right. He said it, his name on the beginning, so if you're listening to this dude, I apologize. But he was on Tinfoil Hat, and I was truly blown away. You know, I read, and the note-taking helps me remember everything when I do the episodes. But his ability to recall names and facts and people and groups, it's truly astonishing. It's really amazing. So we talk Star Forts. We talk Tartaria. We talk the Moors and the Mormons. A whole bunch of stuff. And it's a really great episode. He's probably one of the most knowledgeable people about Tartaria that I have ever met. So it's a really good episode. I think you're really going to enjoy it. I got Billy Ray Valentine. I'll publish that probably next week. And then I got an awesome episode on all the American expositions, you know, those big world fairs, about how none of those make sense. So great episode. I'm really getting into this Tartaria thing. Whether I'm as fully subscribed to the theories as Andreas does, I don't know yet, but it's still very interesting. And like I said, he is amazing with his knowledge. You're really going to be blown away. You'll probably have to listen to it a few times. Even me listening to him, I was like, damn, dude. So it's a great episode. Leave a review on the show. He's on YouTube as well. He also has a Patreon. His Patreon is, I'm so sorry that I didn't come prepared with it, but I'll put all of his links in the show notes as well. But his Patreon is Andreas Xertas. So it's A-N-D-R. I'll put all the links in the show notes. So thanks for him being on the show, taking time out of his busy day to come to this tiny show. It means a lot. And I think that's it, guys. Yeah. So enjoy the day. Enjoy the show. I'll see you guys soon. And that's it. Peace. All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. So today I have Andreas Xertas. So Andreas, I talked to him, or I listened to him on Tinfoil Hat, and I already told him this, but I was so impressed with his ability to recall facts. And it was just, I was blown away with his bank of knowledge in his brain that he could just pull right from the top of his head. So dude, thanks for being on my show.
Thanks for putting my memory on the spot. I hope I do as well today.
No, you will, dude. You are real impressive. So like I said to you, I did the Phantom Time Theory episode, and I'm working on another one about the expositions. So I'm relatively new to like the Tartaria theory. So I keep seeing star forts, and I see like the Statue of Liberty is on a star fort, and I watched a few of your videos. But what is like the significance? What is a star fort? What's like the significance of it? Those kind of things.
Yeah, basically you've got this idea of bastion forts, which look like snowflakes. I have cards here. I don't know how far I have to go to find the one that is the actual picture of a star fort, but if I find it, I'll pull it up for you. Right. Basically, we have this series of cards about it. What a bastion fort was supposed to be was like in the 15th century, the Italian neoclassical architecture was trying to recreate these older shapes, is the story. And so they were reclaiming these originally sacred geometrical city patterns that existed. And we were told that these were military fortifications through and through. And it's true that a lot of these have, they're very defensible positions. So the problem is that not all of them are made in Italy. Not all of them are made in the 15th century. And it's clear that this is something that's been going on since the military has been accumulating more militaries. And Rome didn't, you know, have a great number system, right? Like they weren't using the Arabic numeral system. So it's amazing how we think about Rome as this amazing thing, but it really is the idea that this group of people who raped Tarpeia, you know, they took over the sacking of the Sabines is the story of the Etruscans being raped. And that's when the Romans took over the Etruscan territories. And so that's where they got the military conscription system. And so they had free bread, and they had free monster truck shows at the Colosseum. You could go hang out and everyone, but imagine you had wine and bread for free if you were in Rome. Right. They had to take your brother or you, and you had to be put into the army. You had to be set up to be some sort of a soldier. But that meant all around the world, you know, people were being brought and this would mean that they were bringing their own culture. And so this culture of the Thracians, which we, you know, Taurations, and the Phoenicians, we see that's probably where this came from. The funny thing is the Russians were using this too. And so at one point, California was conquered by the Russians. The northern coast, especially from Alaska down, we have in Santa Cruz and around the Northern California area, like still there are forts that are still there that were created by the Russians and the old religious. Yeah, actually up in the hills in Santa Cruz, there still are like traditional Orthodox kind of like folk magic Russian Orthodox communities. Wow. And this is like hundreds of years ago. Right. It's still there.
Right.
But what you'll find is all of these places have star forts. And so what you look from Google, you can see this area where there's things have changed, you know, there are roads, there's still a snowflake pattern. And, you know, at the end of any city, you'll see these weird, you know, angles, not like just a roof, but like they look like Mario Brother game patterns, basically. Okay. Like you've seen it in Mario Brothers where it looks like really this, and Holland and the Netherlands, they really upkeep their forts. But in Peru, the military, they use a bastion fort that's the same design. And what we've decided, we don't really call them bastion forts anymore because they're 5,000-year-old forts that are in India and they're in Africa. So this is the thing that links together this culture that was erased. And after the erasure, it's been just, you know, claimed as one of the conquered properties and their ideology and their symmetry and their architecture. All that's just been co-opted into, you know, the Roman idea, right?
So is there any like significant, like I've seen some things about energy, especially in like that book I'm reading, Exposing the Exposition, like this geometrical shape or this architecture was more than just because it looked right or looked nice. Is that like tie in with the Star Force, you think?
Yeah, so I really wish I could find that one card. It'd be so great. The thing is, okay, here we go. Found it. All right, so perfect. Here's a star fort.
Right.
And if you look at the light on there just perfectly. There you go.
Yeah.
It has like an outward ring pattern, and then around there's almost invariably a river. And so what they do is the star forts allow for water to be circulated. It becomes fresher. And then they can use that for water mills, and that allowed for electricity and even just before electricity, just for turning of things, but turning of things allow for electricity. It's a natural consequence, right? If you turn something and there's an electromagnetic, you know, coil, and you have, you know, acids and batteries, and we've seen this in ancient Babylon, that this would be, you know, the way that you'd have power mills. And so essentially then you find these rings, right? These star forts become rings because of natural patterns. So Mauritania, there's one, and everyone calls it the Atlantis ring, right? And this has been, everyone's been talking about how, oh, is this Atlantis or is that Atlantis? Right. Atlantis is basically one story Herodotus found about an autonomous city-state of Tartaria. Tartaria is a big empire with a bunch of Atlantis. They're each one of those city-states was self-sustaining. And the self-sustaining cities were about 23 miles. They have a ring. The different star points allow for different neighborhoods. So they're all kind of equally, for the most part, around a water system. They're all along the river, if you will. And because of that, when the water curves around, then they control the water from a bay. And this is also useful for nature because outside of this, you have beavers and you have natural systems. And once these things fall apart, then you can see all these places have turned to desert. So you can kind of do the math on like, this was not desert, like the mega chads lakes in Africa, right? The whole thing is that people that used to cross sand dunes were crossing by boats. Like the dunes were lakes and rivers. So basically,
is that like your theory then for like the Middle East that now is, you know, was so lush and I don't know other words to describe it, but
probably, day after tomorrow style, like changes. I think that a lot of that has to do with bio feedback loops that people don't really think too much about. Do you know what the Russian lake that disappeared?
No, no.
I want to say its name right. So hold on. Lake disappeared. It's like Volnich or Lake Baloy. Yeah, okay. It was a giant lake in Nizhny Novgorod Oblast, and it was like they took 10% of it, but okay. Then every year that's where the rain was supposed to go back into it. So right. Over about 40 years, the lake dried up into a desert. Jeez. And it's, you know, hundreds of miles. It's like Lake Tahoe disappeared is in Russia.
Wow.
And this is happening right now. So you have to think how quickly we can really, in 100 years or less, you can completely destroy a place. But simultaneously, you can bring beavers to New Mexico again, and you'll start seeing they're doing this. It starts to bring back ecosystems because they'll right. start to bring water ponds. So very quickly, nature can build itself back up. I mean, we're going to be seeing in the next 10, 20 years, the Sahara being reclaimed and terraced. It's happening right now. But the problem is that people have no ownership anymore. Like the property values, everything is, you know, brought down to this point where it'll be collectively owned by a small elite. But
okay. Jeez, dude.
They knew about this since the beginning is the thing. And like, so all this technology, when you have, you know, like the Pantelegram machine, which is essentially like a fax machine, they're sending images back and forth. They've been hiding there. The elite have been the only ones allowed to use this up until the 20th century for about 100, 200 years. And then now it's been available more and more for everyone, but at what cost?
Right. Well, I just literally, like, it's so synchronistic. I just read in that book how they showed like that wireless, kind of like the modern day cell phone tower at the St. Louis exposition. And then he referenced there's those old videos. I'm sure most people listening have seen it where there's like those old ladies walking out of a factory or something. And you would swear they're talking on a cell phone. And it's like, I don't know what year, it's early 1900s. But that, I guess, is probably like.
Well, so I try really hard to just focus on like the really blatantly easy, true stuff. There, it could easily be, you know, there's a show from the 60s called Time Tunnel, which is really great because it's all about the government's time travel program. And he's driving through the desert, and all of a sudden the desert opens up, it drops in, and there's this giant city underground, and it connects to all the tunnels across America. And he has to go through the time tunnel, which is the same black and white time tunnel from Austin Powers.
Very funny. The wall. Wow.
But,
yeah.
But there, I mean, if people are messing with time, like that changes a little. The thing that I imagine is that Tartaria could easily be affected by like this. So this is the only reason I'm going into this deep is because today we did an entire episode on EVPs.
Sweet, dude. I love it.
Have you heard about EVP? Do you know about like ghost hunters and stuff?
Okay.
So I met some of these people and I was like, okay, what is the deal? And they're like, well, we're not just looking for ghosts, right? Like this is for paranormal signals. And I was like, what's up with EVPs? Who invented this? Go back to the 1800s, 1740s, and you have like Reichenbach. And people into the 1840s, everyone who invented televisions and radio signals were originally ghost hunters. They were trying to find some way to connect with this weird energy. And so there's thought that the Tartaria radio data signal, this is something that they knew from when this used to work, that they were sending information back and forth. Mm-hmm. And so there were people trying to figure out how to get back in touch with those signals, not realizing maybe that those were from this civilization. Jeez. But also if they're bouncing back and forth, we could be getting old signals from the last civilization that was here that had already been reset.
Damn, dude, that is wild thought.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, and I don't just mean that to be like, that's my own thought either, because to be fair, apparently that's what everyone in the 1840s were trying to find out. Are there paranormal intelligences from, you know, what we consider beyond the metric of time, something that is aware of multiple instances across the scale that can be in both places at once? And we're now seeing that with the linear accelerator with electricity. So there could be some sort of artificial intelligence that has evolved to the point that it can be talking to us in the past, theoretically.
Dude, that's a I don't even know if my brain can handle that that notion.
I know, right? I mean, it's scary, but if you think about it, it explains a lot of things about history revision, because there are things that seem to be changing. And so the flamenco thing is, what if the last 2,000 years or 1,000 years just shuffled on top of each other?
Right.
And then it starts to fit a bit more. Like, we're conformed to this idea that history is so distant. It might not be. And we've got it set up that these are just moments, and moments are, I mean, we've so far not been able to define them outside of change. So theoretically, we could set up an entire new delineation of, have you seen the crab thing where all these crabs are evolving? Popular Mechanics has an article. Randomly, crabs are just evolving. There's like exoskeletal shaped creatures, the same, but all from different DNA, and they're not related at all. So we're wondering, why does this keep naturally happening? Why does this shape work so well that it just happens in nature? And it could be that it's literally just, there are certain things that work when the explosions are coming out from a Big Bang progression. And so theoretically, you could set up a chain of events that with a star, you could have another set to emulate what happened to create Earth, and then that would have in it the same kinds of people that would be having these kinds of conversations at a certain point of the delineation of the explosions of particles, right?
Jeez. So Formenko talks like so it's spread. What do you think? You think that's the purpose, to make things seem so ancient that it doesn't interest people? Or like, what would be the point of extending history so?
I think that there's a, I think, well, so that's an interesting, you know, dilemma if it's true, right? Like, right. So at least pursue the thought. So what makes, why would they want you to think that? Well, if the story is of 2000 years ago, because we have this whole calendar around this character, Jesus, right? And so Jesus, if he's 1000 years ago, which is like the time of knights and swords,
right?
And if Moscow is Jerusalem, because that's the other thing about Flamenco, is a lot of the cities are names that have traded after a major fire. People pick up and move. A mud flood destroys a city, and they move it somewhere else. And so they've gone south, or they've gone west, and then they found this place which is more centric. And it's the one place where they can kind of build up. So that, and by the way, Moscow is one of the craziest star forts in the world, of course. I mean, it's huge. It's like a mega star fort. But yeah, this idea that some of these major, so Jesus could have been from Damascus or from Constantinople or from other places than we originally think, but it's still coming through Africa, through Carthage and Egypt. So likely Joseph would have been in Carthage in the 11th century when Hannibal has lost and things are changing. And there's a Roman census. And so this Roman census is where everyone's forced to go back to the places that have been colonized. So for tax purposes, he takes his wife to Jerusalem. And then from Jerusalem, which is, you know, if this is the case, is Moscow, then to go back to live in Alexandria in Egypt. So this is a huge journey all of a sudden. And it starts saying, wait, if this is the case, then what's the truth about Constantinople? Like, what really, because like, this is a place now where there's major contention in Turkey, because Istanbul is the city, it was Constantinople, it's Istanbul. And they're in Syria, it's got the same problem. They're blowing up these oldest churches they can find, mosques that have been converted into churches and back and forth. So if we're losing these original buildings, then these buildings were built 1000 years ago with this tech. If they're built with this technology and they're using like Royal Rife style harmonic healing frequencies, solfeggio tonality, like we're talking about 422 hertz and all these special healing frequencies, people are going to these buildings to heal themselves, right? So this is also when the plague happens, is when these buildings get shut down.
Very interesting.
So I think they want to separate time mainly because they want it to look like this. I don't know if it's fair to say that, but it seems very relevant that the past sounds so primitive to a level that it can't be useful to you. It's not applicable. And then if you find out it's not, that it's really close, it's really similar, and that it's more approachable, then all of a sudden it matters more what happened. But the other thing is they've moved everyone from all these countries. They've changed the names. Germany wasn't a place. Italy wasn't a place. Spain wasn't a place. Like, Europe is 200 years old. So just imagine.
Yeah, really? That's a statement, dude.
Yeah, I mean, America and Europe are not like different in age. And it really offends some people. If you think about it, really, there's a lot more history in America than you hear about. And there's a lot less history of Europe than they'll admit, because they've rewritten it, and they've toned out all of the Dark Ages. And during what they call the Dark Ages is the Age of Light, right? Because that's when the Muslims have allowed, like, Maimonides is running Spain, and Spain is under the Cordoba Caliphate, which stretches all the way to Khazaria. So it's not even Europe at that point. It's this Moorish Empire.
So you think, Dirk, because that was in that Phantom Age thing, it has like the idea that the Islam had the golden age during the Dark Ages and Europe was backwater stuff, but he goes into like, I mean, just from Illig, it was like there's very little archaeological evidence to support that, and he like makes claim that both made it up. So you're saying that from your research that the Moors controlled all of that area.
Well, so you so the thing is that the Moors are what is left over from the fall of the 1666 fire and whatever's changed from old Tartaria. And so you've got the Tartarians and the Tarkhans, which have come from Georgia, and then they've come the Khazar kings have come through, and the Cordoba Caliphate extends. And at that point, it becomes what we call Islam. But Islam today has nothing to do with Islam before the Flamenco timeline.
Interesting.
Because Islam basically means bliss or submission and being part of the yoga. And at that point, you could be Christian, Jewish, whatever. Like, it didn't really, like, Maimonides had set up, you know, in Spain that, like, you could be different kinds of religions, and all kinds of people were coming with all sorts of philosophies. Mm-hmm. And the Moors were eventually inherited that system. So you have the Berbers and you have the Thracians, right? They have these, you can see where they've been, because they have water systems, they have aqueducts, they have things that, you know, theoretically, you know, the water houses are what divide the barbarians, which we call the Tartars. But that's because they've had their, you know, and this is the story has been turned in verse. They say that the barbers cut the water aqueducts, which destroyed Rome. But theoretically, it was that the Roman system designed to destroy the barber, you know, economy, and it made and took away the civilization that they already had. So you go to South Spain, there are giant aqueduct systems with giant statues. They're essentially Roman, you know, statues, but they're not, like, these are Thracian statues, because they've conquered these people and they've had them build these things. The thing about the Moors, though, is, like, they continued to control the trade unions and the trade routes. So there were Black people and white people and people of different colors that were part of Tartaria. I think that's an important distinction. It's not an ethno state. And across the board, you have Moors that were traveling to the Americas doing a triangular trade long before Britain. And Britain inherited that trade system. So Bermuda to America, and even the Pequot Indians, were already dealing with African, I don't know if you can even say African descent, because we're not even sure this could be an into Africa theory. At this point, when we start to acknowledge that these people had boats, then it could be that they actually ended up, like, from the Moluccan Islands in the Caribbean. And this is an interesting idea, into Africa, which, you know, that idea is pretty much my favorite, is that everyone at one point traveled by boats before they did this giant land travel, because it's just so much longer to walk across the place than just to go back and forth. You had brought up the Mormon thing at some point. That's the Book of Mormon, basically. So that's where when you're a kid, you're told that Bigfoot, JFK, you know, all these things but really bipedal humans exist. And, you know, you can get into stuff about the government, but, like, for sure, when you look at the Book of Mormon, like, there's a little bit more to it than you see. And this idea that there's a flood, like the Noah flood, there's definitely been a deluge. And then there's five sons with five different wives that have five different races. And then that makes up the new kids on the block from whatever's left of humanity. And then those go to the Americas, and they also go to Eurasia. And then they're spreading back and forth with boats, the Scythians and the Aryans. And then there's also the Lehites and the Lemites and Nephites.
So you think the Book of Mormon has, because I mean, I know the story, you know, Joseph Smith talked to some angel he got when he was 12 years old. He got gold, written in gold, and then he lost the tablets or whatever, that he wasn't allowed to collect them. So you're saying, is that a story that's made up to discredit his theory or his story?
No, I mean, I think grifters exist, and it's not, I'm not taking it away. I'm just saying that, you know, he was raised by a well-witcher, and his dad was also, and there's a clearly Freemason origin. And this is at a time when Freemasonry, by the way, is transitioning out of the Jesuits, because the Jesuits have just been suppressed and they're looking for a place to go.
Interesting.
And I think this is something that's underplayed, is that the Jesuits were kicked out of every country in the world. Half of Japan was killed. Paraguay was a crazy war. And then there are two countries that they were allowed to stay. And one of them was, you know, under Catherine the Great in Belgium, and the other was the United States.
Right.
I mean, they were kicked out of Canada, but they stayed in the United States. And so if they were able to be in New York and they were able to find their way into, you know, the Freemasons, then, you know, that the Freemasons have to be excommunicated to be Catholic. It's perfect logic that they're working together. So they have something that's outside of the Catholic Church. And then they needed a religion, because Freemasonry is not technically a religion. I mean, it's got every trapping of it, but it's not technically a religion. So you put that together through the LDS church. I'm one of my videos, I've got a picture of a tab that says LDS, and it's like, try LDS for Latter-day Saints. Like, it's a psychedelic, because it is a crazy idea. But the Mormons do have some access to some real truth. And you have to imagine, this is a group that goes all around the world looking for places where their temples can go. Sorry for all the flat earthers, like all around the world. But like when you find the different temples, like these are like Tartarian cathedral style buildings that they've resurrected in all these cases. And there are caves underneath these buildings. And, you know, have you heard of Kolob? You know, that they believe that there's a star that's in Alpha Centauri called Kolob, where Jehovah is sending radio signals to the earth. And that's what they're receiving, is light from a star called Kolob. So, I mean, the Latter-day Saints, they're pretty interesting if you really give them a shot.
Yeah, dude, that's a very interesting, but you're right. Like, Jesuits were kicked out everywhere. And Joseph Smith was, he had Freemason rituals he was doing, right? And all that
stuff. if you end up in like the higher degrees, then you start putting symbols onto the aprons and things. But originally, like these rituals, they seem like Canaanite style Hermetic rituals. And so the Freemasons were really interested in the Hermetic rituals and the Kemetic rituals. You have alchemy, which is the right. Allen law in Spanish. It's like forwards and backwards, right? Because like you read right to left.
I see, right.
So your alchemy is a study of Kemet, and Kemet's Africa. Like, or it's instead of Egyptus, they said Kemet, KMT, which is like, you know, the original name. And, you know, so Ptahotep was from Kemet. You also have algebra, right? The study of the Hebrew. And that's like, you know, algebra, you know. So these number systems, and tarot and Torah, you know, because without vowels, but it's, you can imagine without vowels to try to pick which one, but one is wisdom through gestalt, through shape, and the other is wisdom through scripture, right? So through words and through, you know, meta-tagged experiences. So they're trying to do rituals, is the thing. Like Freemasons do these plays where they wear these robes and they enact these characters, which is very much gestalt psychotherapy. And it's supposed to put you in a position where you end up, you know, finding something that was found by somebody who did it before. It's like very not Taoist.
Okay. You know? Dude, that's a wild, wild theory, dude. That's like I'm going to have to, as I said, I'm just like the beginning of this, but that was a wild connection. So you also mentioned like the Khazars, and I've heard that like phrase so much, like from Khazaria and stuff. What is their relation then to Tartaria
So the thing about Tartaria is, like, if you look in anthropology class, you start studying it, they talk about super far west Tartaria, super far east Tartaria. And it's like, really, it's because it went everywhere. Mm-hmm. But as it started to disintegrate, and what it looks like is in the Caribbean and Polynesian areas, just outside of like Solent, which is now, you know, beyond New Zealand, like the entire there was an explosion. Krakatoa and a number of different volcanoes were probably power plants associated with these star forts.
Jeez, dude.
And crazy. They went off. And when they went off, it started to destroy all of the connectivity between the different autonomous states. And the autonomous states then were being destroyed. And that's when you start to see corporate commercial pirates that take over what's left of the empire that's scattered. And it starts to retract back towards the center. And that center point is now Georgia. And so Georgia is an interesting spot because it's a cradle of civilization, one of them. You know, people talk about Sumer, but it's a place of the Denisovan. And so Soichi is where they had the Olympics a few years ago. It's where they found the other. So we can talk about Neanderthal, we talk about Fioriensis, we talk about Heidelbergensis, we talk about Homo erectus, I mean, like Australopithecus, we could go on, but Denisovan, right? Denisovan is this big guy. He's like Cro-Magnon, but smarter. And he's, you know, pretty much like another Neanderthal, but fully, you know, we haven't fully sequenced how many people, what percentage they are Denisovan yet, but we're seeing something between like the same as Neanderthal, like 1 to 5 or 1 to 7%. We used to think that all people in Western Europe were Neanderthal and some were Denisovan in Eastern Europe, not necessarily the case anymore. We're seeing Denisovan everywhere. And we see Denisovan and Fioriensis mixed together in New Zealand and in Polynesia, which means that, you know, tens of thousands of years ago or generations ago, at least, that these people were meeting places from, you know, from the center of what we call Tartaria all the way to the place that we call East and West Tartaria. So like they were definitely interacting with each other. We know that now, but Georgia is the final resting place for, on the map, when you get those bar maps of the earth from the 1800s, Tartaria is on there, and it's right in Georgia. And that's because it was the last place to hold down. And that's where the Khazar kings came from. And so they ended up controlling that and going, and from there they spread out and they went through all the places that had been destroyed, all the city after city, and they arrived and they said, well, everything looks pretty much destroyed here. We claim it and conquer it. And they did this so successfully that they carried themselves all the way to Spain from Russia, from East Russia, you know, all right. the way to Spain.
Right.
And that's how the Khazar kings really came to power. They had been generals, they had been a nobility class of generals in Tartaria, while Tartaria was still an extended kingdom, you know, that had been, because there were royal families, there were essentially, you develop a class system, because an endless summer trade system, and it would allow people to go from winter, they would go to summer, and so every time it was summer trade, so people in the winter would get summer fruit, and then people in the winter would get summer fruit, and this would allow them to accumulate, you know, beyond wealth, right? This is like grosser mercantilism. You use the wealth to invest to create a more brilliant society. So things were getting really great, and it seems like they had free electricity, and then all of a sudden things collapse, and that's where things get fuzzy, because you can't just be sure. I'd love to say, you know, it was just a natural disaster. It was just an accident. I can't be sure of that. It could literally be that there was effort to destroy these power plants and to destroy some of these volcanoes, which would have been like Chernobyl events.
Right.
And that could have literally happened and destroyed a lot of, you know, we look at the Alvarez hypothesis even, that something big happened and it might have been intentional.
How do you like know for a fact, because you speak so matter of fact, like the trade of fruits and things like that, how do you base that, like what evidence do you use to say that?
So one of the fun things is, like, so I was in anthropology growing up, and like, okay. Long story short, the Tartarian, the oldest thing we have in the world is not a Sumerian tablet anymore. It's a Tartarian tablet from Gradus Nitsa. And so in Bulgaria, they found this old tablet, and it's written in Tartar, and it has pictures on both sides, and one of them is of animals, and then the other one is of trees with fruit. And what it is, as far as we could now essentially prove, is it's a futures trading. And I intuited this actually years ago, because I was taking anthropology and I'd studied Slavs. There's a really great book called Dalmatians of Pajaro Valley, which is all about how the Croatians exodus to the United States, to California. And they found this region that was, you know, perfect, wow, where Jack Kerouac ended up, and where, you know all that.
Parsons, like those people?
Well, he was further south. Parsons was like Burbank, but like Steinbeck and all these writers that were out in this area.
Yeah.
And so he talked about like this new Dalmatian empire that was forming in this area. And so what they were doing was they were doing futures trading, because they were farmers, and farmers, some of them know these tricks, right? And I'm gonna teach you a trick that's like, you know, theoretically only farmers should teach their firstborns. But what you do is you measure the length of a branch of a tree and how many branches it has and how many fruit it has on each branch. And from that, you're able to predict, essentially Mendelbrot math, how many trees are going to be part of this larger expanded field naturally to grow, and how many branches, unless they're pruned, are going to, and you can theoretically say what's logical, are going to grow, and how much fruit's going to come from that. And you can predict that from one tree, from one branch. And essentially they do that to say, well, this amount of fruit is, you're probably going to have this from your crop next year. I want to trade that for, you know, I have this. And they can measure using a goat, kind of in a similar way with certain animals. You can say, okay, well, this litter was this size, it came from this size, you know, I want to trade this amount of fruit next year for that amount of goat. And it's not actually accurate to like a number. It's accurate to like a futures prediction.
Right.
And so this was like what we were finding all over South America when I was down there, is that the Peruvian, you know, Quechua were doing futures trades. And so when we went and we saw this in Bulgaria, it was like the first thought I had is like, this is obviously not like a, this isn't just like a religious talisman. And like, like there was very few places to go with it, but like the fact that we're able to pick up on Tartar and its relationship to Uralic languages in Sanskrit, and just because we've seen more tablets of that nature ever since, it started to really cement the fact that trade was the ultimate goal of these people, which is also what we've heard about the Phoenicians, right? And the Phoenicians come from Tyre and Tar. So, so this is important to try to prove, because actually it's a weird idea. Most people don't believe that society can start on trade. Most, you know, actually it's a fundamental rule in anthropology for the most part that society is built on war. and that we're constantly hating each other, and that right. scarcity has driven us to build these star forts, which are not designed to like harness nature to create abundance, but actually to sequester our wealth. And it's like siege us, like that it doesn't work, you know. And what makes more sense is, you see, anytime you have an ethno state, anytime you have an isolatory state, they're when they're closed off, they tangent for a while and they refine, but they refine. They don't actually expand. They don't become great. Like, you know, these trade empires get super great, super fast. And so it's just, it's an inevitability that there would be one that wasn't so keen on being, you know, the only thing in the world. It doesn't care who you are or what you are. It just cares, you know, how you are able to communicate and harmonize this trade system.
Dude, that's a great point. That's really like a great, point with how, if you close, like I feel like Japan, right, they did that for a long time, and that's an interesting. So how do the Phoenicians are part of the Tartaria, because I just read something else like on the Phoenicians and how that relates to the Knights Templar or whatever, but that was their thing, like they didn't force religion, suppose, you know, that's
right. And so that's, again, we should get into the flamenco thing. We have a great guy, Hugo, some guy who has a channel, and he's, you know, check out Hugo's channel, because it's all about the Phoenicians for the most part. And he's kind of contentious to the flamenco thing. So he just focuses on the mainstream narrative about Phoenicians. The funny thing is, he still can't negate, or, and he doesn't like the Tartaria thing, because at the end of the day, Phoenicians never existed. No one ever called Phoenicians until they were long gone. We recently started doing that. Like they had a bunch of different names based on where they were saying, oh yeah, the guys who use phonemes, I mean, that started to happen, like they're like, these guys write sounds down, that's interesting. But for the most part, you have people from Tyr and Tar, you know, and you have Thracians, and you have these different groups. So yeah, they were essentially the same. They were like the fatherland. Tar has a lot to do with the fatherland. And if you look into, you know, the Sanskrit roots of Aryan, that means noble, right? So the Tar, the father noble, you know, groups. And so there were a lot of people that were having these tribarchies. And so the tribarchies were working together.
Jeez, dude. I don't know what a tribarchy is, but...
You ever see like in Africa, like the Sands people, the Bushmen, like they'll have like a family of like 20 people around a major figurehead.
Okay.
And this is in the Americas.
I see, you see tribarchy.
Yeah. And you have a number of tribes. And in North America, this was very common as well. Like Native American tribes, you'd have chiefs that would actually be at the same level. And then they would interact with each other based on certain times they would come together. Seldomly would they all come together, but they would interact. They had, though, a confederacy. And that's one of the first things we go into in the Tartary series, is the Americans were continuing the Indian Confederacy, the Native Confederacy that had existed.
Dude, so that's the other big thing I keep, like the Civil War or Napoleon. I think you recommended a guy, Conspiracy R Us, I think, on, so I watched his like French, you know, how they built everything like 12, these magnificent things in 12 years. So what is like the significance between these? So it's, your theory is it's strategic, the locations of the wars or the battles.
Yeah, and so the other thing is, afterwards, to claim these cities, they had to, hold on 1 second.
This dude is one of the smartest people, everybody. So we're just waiting 1 sec here.
Sorry, there was a loud outside.
No worries, man.
But
so like the battles, that's what
so right. So the locations for the cities of today are, you know, on top of the mud flooded locations of old cities. Not every single building, you know, obviously there's very few left. You go to certain places, like you go to Valencia, Spain, you go to Chicago, you go to parts of California that had been earthquaked, and you start to see the few leftover buildings that exist. New York obviously has some still, but they, you know, like Harlem was destroyed, like the Bronx was destroyed. A lot of these buildings are gone, but we can go back and we can see some of the brick efforts that went into strategic military points. You see Paris is a great example. It's really centric. It's got as far away from the coast of every coast in the square state as possible. So Paris is like, it's an inevitably great military location. So the cities we see today, a lot of them are places where they tore things down and brought things to them. And during the you know, the World's Fair, you know, exhibitions all around the world, they would bring things to these places. Yeah. Now, some of these places that are so far flung that it's like, why did they do this? Yeah. Those are places where Tartaria was, you know. So you go to South America and you're like, why did they build this, you know, like there's like Indians here in like the rainforest. Why did they build this giant rubber? Why would this rubber company from Portugal, you know, come in and build this giant city that looks like Paris in the 1800s, you know? And so the reason being, it was already set up, it was already built. And then they moved in. And so they set up these exhibitions and they said, you know, we're going to build this new world culture. And they have all these statues, and they've changed the heads, but these buildings, they're not necessarily meant to follow permits. And so they say, well, within a year, we're going to tear it all down anyway.
Yeah. Right.
And so this is like the beginning of the Burning Man culture, you know, this sort of like, okay, it's all right if we're building the Tower of Babel and we're going to get torn down. We're going to do it over and over and over again. We're going to slash and burn our art. It's a self-sacrifice Wicker Man kind of ritual that is being played out. And so they set up these fairs to bring all these people in. Helen Keller is the only one allowed to touch the Chicago exhibition, right? She's the one who can't see.
Isn't she like not here. Even, I'm sure you've seen that conspiracy right. theory that she's not that, but continue. Oh man,
that is so terrible. I mean, right? And I knew a girl who said that back in high school. And
really?
Ivy Zedrick, and I'll always say her full name so you can find out if she's right. But she totally called this. I'm like, yeah. Man, that's diabolical. But it's when you start to look into it, you're like, oh my, you're right. That actually happened. And then, so what did they have her touch the walls? Like, what were they, what kind of weird, it's not just a lie. It's actually like a diabolic, it's like terrifying. Like, can you imagine this poor girl?
But so that, so like the World War II, we'll just use that example. So that was to help cover up more of the, to help erase more history.
I think also to claim new lands, to get rid of old sons. You know, you have all these kids in Australia and New Zealand that were drafted to fight for England, right? Because how small is England? And it has to go up against all of Europe. So it has to get as many people from as many other places it owns as possible. And so, you know, this is the last wrap up of foundlings. And so, you know, behind me, you've got these foundling kids, right? Yeah. And it's kind of tragic, but what they were doing was they were taking kids, you know, I mean, for one thing, you'll have like a church and then there'll be a door and then it'll open and you put the baby, it's like a dumpster. You put the baby in and you close the door and then it opens on the other side and the nun takes the baby. And so people were just taking, you know, giving their babies for one thing, but also babies were being taken from people. And 40,000, you have records now where we show that they were taking babies back and forth. If you want to see something really dark, look into baby farms in the 1890s, because there were so many people that were infertile, had mumps, had sickness. You know, we talk about Napoleon's Comet and how some people associate that there was radiation involved with that. For whatever reason, people were not having kids in certain generations. And so there'd be 20 years in some of these points, between, you know, like we have years without summer, we have generations without children, like total city of men circumstances. And that could be something that's happening to us, right? Because by 2045, we're about to hit, there's predictions, we're going to have zero sperm count for average for a lot of, you know, we've depleted like 80% in the last 100 years, you know, so we could be hitting, you know, a similar point where all of a sudden the next line of babies comes, you know, maybe 70 years between 20 to 70 years between the next, and they can't remember the society that existed before it, which is easier to control.
Interesting. Yeah, that's what that was a good quote in his book. He said, like, it takes one generation to forget the past, and then the rest of the world even quicker or whatever. So you think that I guess this is the question, I've heard like the answer before, but this great power, like how would it, that seemed to be more focused on trade than violence and enslavement, why would it ever lose?
So that's a great question. I think that's a lot of what everyone who thinks about an ancient high civilization kind of struggles with. And it's scary mainly because how is that going to hit us? Because we're a pretty great civilization and we're seeing how growth can only go so far because you have to keep sustaining the growth, right? Right. It's either you could plateau at some point, right? But we never do. We just keep going up. At some point, there's going to be 100 billion people that can't eat.
Yeah.
When that happens, all the growth that we've made, it doesn't just drop here. It drops all the way down. You know, 90 billion people could die.
Yeah.
Or 90%, or it could be half a million people left, like the Georgia Guidestone says. So we have to imagine, like, you know, how quick, all right, again, with the official history of Rome, when the aqueducts were blocked, you know, the barbarians didn't even have to go into town. They're 10 miles out of town, supposedly. Right. And now Rome isn't able to drink water and they have to live in feces. And then, you know, they start dying very quickly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It takes about a week before you've lost maybe like 100,000 or a million people. So it could have been very quick. And then we also think about the devastation of tidal waves and tsunamis and things that have happened because of volcanoes and earthquakes. And mm-hmm. tsunamis can easily wash away places, middle plains. You know, you have mud floods, and that's a big one. Is like in Peru, they still have these things called huaicos, which are mud floods. And so after the water comes, it brings up the sediment, and then that brings an entire layer of dirt that levels you. So I have a good interview with Wendy Shaw, who plays Francine on American Dad, and her house was buried with a mud flood, and it was just perfect. So we were talking, it was right after I started looking into mud floods. I was like, yeah, the thing is that actually exists. And she's like, I know. But like, this, it's a pretty big deal when you start to find that some of these cities are literally buried in mud. They had to pick up sticks, move elsewhere. You could see like what would happen if you lived in New York City, and all of a sudden the power went out for 20 years and it was buried the first few floors up in mud. You know, like that would be the end for a lot of things.
Yeah. So that's the theory. Is it just knocked out, whether it was a global or a localized?
Well, I'd really like to believe that. The thing is, I don't fully. The dark notion, right, is that somebody destroyed it on purpose. Yeah. And so it could be that it wasn't a very equal society. It could be that, you know, some people had made so much wealth for their familial aristocracy that they owned things. And there were lower people that were like, you know, this is not Marxist enough. Like, we're going to, but there should, you know, theoretically, a free electricity, free food is, you know, imagine a future where scarcity is gone. That's the past. So what was the real contention there? I can imagine if people were doing work and they felt like they were working for other people, you know, especially you've got like the Dutch were controlled, the 70-year war, the Dutch were controlled by the Spanish. They used to be controlled by the Moors. Before that, they were controlled by the Tartarians. And being handed over and being controlled by these people that didn't speak the same language as them, that were manipulating them, and that they were being told that they had to, run these boats to go back and forth on these long routed transit systems. I mean, it's eventually you could see that they could consider that nepotistic. Yeah. And they might rise up and to say, we can take it. The story of Caesar is this. It could be metaphored that the Caesars, the czars, you know, are the czars of the sea, you know. And like, there's actually been talk about this idea that really, like, Caesar represents the warriors that said, why are we working for this aristocracy that has arrived into power? The aristocracy was there because they had long endured, their families were multi-generationally invested in this land. And so in this empire and this trade network, so they had little reason to corrupt that system and the most reason to sustain that system. Yeah, so but there could have been a dynamic argument there. That's where it becomes so hypothetical, it's beyond me. But okay. You look into Atlantis and Herodotus, and he talks a bit about that. He talks about the matriarchy systems. Women were in charge, which is why judges wear wigs in England today, because they're following the alchemic courts of Ptahotep, which they follow. They had women in charge of these courts, and that goes back to Baalbek for the system administration.
Jeez. Do you think this is like in the Freemasonry and whatever secret societies, this is some of the information that is so coveted and taught to their, you know, the top levels?
Definitely. So like, I've been a few times approached by Freemasons, and I still haven't made like an oath where I have to keep secrets or something with them, but like, they definitely, you know, like in the Morals and Dogma, they mentioned Tartars like 13 times, for instance. And that's like Albert Pike's
right. book. Yeah.
No one really talks about his Aryan, Indo-Aryan Vedic book, but he has another book which even goes deeper into the Slavic Aryans and their interaction with the Scythians and this idea of, you know, the Viking runestones, because he was traveling around the United States and seeing some of the runestones that were existing.
Yeah.
And so he was thinking, wow, like clearly the Scandinavians and the Scythians, you know, from Tibet were interacting with each other. I mean, so yeah, they knew about this. And it's funny though, in the Morals and Dogma, he talks about how it was taken from them, like their blessing was taken from them because they were lazy or something like that. Okay. So, I mean, it kind of gives you a little idea. But, you know, what do they say? Like, we know how the pyramids were built. We know the secrets of Atlantis. We know, like,
that's true. But, yeah.
But they don't always talk too much about Tartaria because it might be too close to, you know, the truth, right?
Interesting, dude. Yeah, you're right. That's what they talk about. And it all kind of connects. It's like perfect meshing there.
One time I went to a Freemason temple to take some photos like outside, and this dude runs out to like say hello to us. Yeah. And I, you know, there's a thing called being a Mason at site, which is where like, you know, the book, you know, the rituals, you know, all the stuff.
Okay.
And so I'll often make like jokes with Freemasons. Like you'd be like, knock three times, you know, I'm like, hey, help a widow's son out. Like,
whatever. Oh, nice. Yeah.
Do the handshakes with them. So this guy comes and tries to shake my hand and asks me if I'm a Freemason. And I shake his hand like a Freemason, of a third degree. And I say to him as I'm shaking his hand, looking at him, no, I'm a Mason at site, perhaps. Or I forget. I said, no, my grandfather was a Freemason. I think is how it started. So he brings us into the temple, my friend Ethan and I. And we go walking through, like seeing all the stuff. Like, this is the fireplace that was brought from Abraham Lincoln to San Francisco. Yeah. And this is the Scottish Rite room with all of the outfits. And look at all of the aprons of all of the grand masters that have come before us. And let me take you into the temple room. And then he's checked me like multiple times to see if I was lying about my grandfather. And like, apparently, the records were clear enough. He was like, okay, he's not wrong. Yeah. So he brings me into this pitch black room, and he's supposed to go find the light switch. And he says, well, hold on. It's a little dark in here. And then, so I pull out my phone and, oh, this is, by the way, so in a Freemason ritual, I don't know if I'm allowed to tell you that, but like you go into the dark and then you're just like, I'm in darkness. Yeah. Like, show me the light, you know? And so I was like, so he's like, it's a little dark in here. Hold on. And then I take out my phone and I turn on the flash and I'm like, oh, do you need a light? And I shine it over him. And like, so he's like lit up the whole temple with my phone. And I was like, whoa, I don't know. I mean, that was where I realized at this point that like, and they really want, like Freemasons want that, but I need to open source everything they like before, like if we completely open source all of this information and all of this stuff is, then maybe we can go further. But I mean, the secret keeping thing is just, I'm not ready to justify that yet.
So I'm from Philadelphia. I've been to that Freemason. I was a drug addict for a while, so I don't remember going in, but I have like a few photos. But so you think that even those, and like City Hall, like all those buildings are also built with from ancient time or from.
So, a lot of them are resurrected. So you look at, especially in Philadelphia and New York and Washington, D.C., like some of them are old, but like the Bronx were, you know, in some of those places, I have to go to Pittsburgh and I have to see some of the ones that I, you know, have you seen John Levi's channel? Have you seen his stuff?
I don't think so. No.
Really, really recommend. Great guy. He does really good work. And what he'll do, and he's a mind blower. The way he's fun. He's interesting. All right, great. Good channel. Good just personality. But he goes into like all of the Chicago buildings, all the Pennsylvania buildings, goes through the old 1800s pictures with maps and shows which buildings are the original buildings. And you know, but you go look at like the Lincoln Memorial between the you know, Washington DC, and you can see that that's been recreated. It's been remortared together. They're taking blown up marble and they're gluing marble back together, because they have processes that they can do that, which is the opposite, by the way. The word sincerely means without wax, because they didn't ever want people to do that originally. And you know, the old Roman and Tartarian styles, you had to always sign a statue that you didn't fill the cracks that you made with wax. But now we're just, that's what all that stuff is made of. So some of that stuff is just totally fake. And it's, I mean, theoretically, you know, the idea that sounds weird to people, because like, well, it's really made 100 years ago. It's like, yeah, that's the point. Like some of that other stuff though is, you know, statues that were brought from Italy, or and they were, their heads were mounted to older statues that had been here already. Dude, do you know the cherry tree story with George Washington?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So like that's the big one, is that the George Washington chopped down a cherry tree. George Washington's a quarter black or an eighth black, right? A lot of these people were part of these slave trading families, and they wore powder on their face, because in certain parts of Britain, it was cold. It's totally cool in France, but in certain parts of Britain, the Germans were, they had problems with the black nobility, because it had been black families that had been in charge of Germany, like not, but centuries prior. And so the Moors had an association with the Africans. And so they had to try to emulate white culture at what was understood to be British and European white culture, which was this fabricated thing at that time. But the cherry tree is also the name of the Moorish flag. So it's a red flag with a green pentagram, and the pentagram is actually a star, right? Like a star for it.
Right.
But it's supposed to be a vertical tree, because if you look down an aerial view of a tree, you'll see it actually comes out like a star, like, and it grows.
Right.
So the idea is he took down, and there's pictures of him, you know, where he's standing there and he's got a red flag on the ground behind him. And the red flag has a green line. You can see it's the beginning of the Moorish flag. And the deal is that he took down the Moorish flag of his father, and then he put up the new flag, which was and so the other thing is the red and the yellow and black and yellow flag.
Yeah.
The original, like snake on it.
Oh, yeah.
That's from the Tartarian flag system, because they had black and yellow. Yeah. And they would use the soy or the ash charcoal on top of a yellow, often from mustard to make these, to dye their flag. And it could also be kind of blood. There's sometimes they use blood and it starts to turn to a yellower hue. Right. But they would paint the animal that was, so you had either a griffin or an owl, and then they have a snake. And so these are to represent areas that were of the grand, but a lot allied in a place that you could trade and be part of Tartaria.
Interesting.
So he was trying to bring back the Tartarian Empire. And so that's what a lot of the Freemasons were all about, was that we can rekindle and control this thing that's been falling apart.
So this is my like last, so the elites like now, or the fake elites, or you want to call them, are they probably have this information. Are they trying to recreate? Because I feel like Blavatsky and Bailey, they all are trying to form a new Atlantis, or is that what you think their goal is? Or?
Yeah, I think that they're slowly allowing people to accumulate the progress to the point where they slash and burn our society. It's like a tax. And so they get us built up. And then we have also been spending so much of this wealth, this inflated wealth system, that we'll have nothing. And so then they'll own this new solution to all these problems, which is, we've created all these problems in the last 100 years, really, that right. they're all really quickly solvable just by getting off of this system and going back to the old system. But we won't have any control over that, because it'll be a benevolent beehive that they kind of control. Right. The other thing is, culture will probably be erased. It looks like that's a big thing. Is the Freemasons talk about Operation Discovery sometimes, which is like this idea that you can have all the information put out in front of you. And it was from 1989 to about 2001. And then they start to classify things again until it's a need to know. And then eventually it's like, there will be one giver, and like most people will probably forget everything else. And it'll be easy to start a new society, because you'll just say, these were the gods, these statues were the old ways. Like, and you can completely rekindle. Like, this is what they do to children. They take them to a church. Like, these statues were this. This is your new language, and they just continue on.
Interesting, dude. Wow. So what books should people, I like to read, but obviously check out your books, but what are like some other good beginner books for people that, obviously they're not going to have your knowledge, but to see some of these connections in real time kind of.
I guess I wish I had my copy of the London Fire 1666. Let me see, 1666 London Fire book. So I just got this book the other
few. Oh, nice. Because there's not many there's like one I have, and then that Howie McDock.
Check out The Great Fire of London in 1666 by Walter George Bell.
All right.
And then also there's a book on Jesuit suppression, which is, a great introduction.
Yeah.
By the Jesuit Suppression in Global Context, first edition, edited by Jeffrey Burson and Jonathan Wright. But the Jesuit Suppression in Global Context, and I can send you a link to that. Sweet. But if you're looking for something that's just straight Tartaria stuff, David Feisenberg Jr. He has a really interesting series. I don't know, like, I can't vouch for everything because I haven't read everything in his book, but he's been collecting a lot of the data and research. And this is a very plastic field of knowledge, because as time goes on, we're finding contradictions even to what we originally knew, because we're basing things on fake news in history, right? I used to work for CNN and look at CNN's news and help them write and now it's like, to pay back, amends, I'm like looking back and trying to find the truth in fake history. So you have to know that sometimes you'll be like, all right, well, this actually turns out to have been a lie, and we have to, redact that. So I know he's done some things about Egypt and a lot of the ideas that some of the runes we see in Egypt, a lot of them were taken. The things we see now are fake, like Stonehenge, he likes them, he says is fake. I haven't been to check myself, just so David Feisberg Jr.'s books have a lot of different ideas. But his books on Mudflood Tartaria, he's got like a dozen 100-page books now on all the aspects of it.
Dude. I think I've seen his around, but that's great. Well, thanks so much for being on my, man. You are, like I said, you're very impressive, dude. You're the way you got history locked down like that, or all those names. And It takes a lot of skill and a lot of time. So I'm thank you for putting all that hard work in.
Thanks a lot for having me. I hope that, I think we scattered in different directions. I hope I answered your questions well.
It was good.
Cool.
Where can people find your information and stuff to watch, all your videos and all that kind of stuff?
So you can, on Twitter, you can find Andreas Exertus. If you go to exertus.com or you go to Tartary Nova, we have a Discord and a Matrix chat, which is an uncensorable permaweb alternative that they can never block because they already tried to. So we have a huge community there. And if you find Exertus on YouTube or Odyssey, you can find the XIRTUS channel, start there. Perfect. If you go to Odyssey and you type MK Ultra, first thing that comes up is my 5-hour video on Tavistock mind control programming.
Awesome, dude. I'll have to check that one out as well. So, dude, thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And you have a good night.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon, man.
See you around.